When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we talk to Heidi Zack. She founded Third Love in 2013 to change how women buy bras. The company pioneered half sizes, lets customers try before they buy, and has amassed 150 million data points from real women to ensure a better fitting bra. We'll talk about making all that work and the importance of things like moving quickly and asking really great questions. Hi, Heidi. How are you?
Hi, Linda. How are you?
Very, very good. Very good. I'm excited to have you here.
Thanks. Excited to be here.
Very good. So when you and I first met, it was many, many moons ago near the beginning of your company. You and I met at South By in 2014. You were doing press meetings at a restaurant there. I saw some of Third Love's first products just out there in the booth. You were talking to people. Those are the early days. What's happened since?
Wow. It's been a crazy 3.5 years since then. We've come a long way. We currently have over 1 million customers. We have donated over $3 million worth of bras to women in need, and we've had over 8 million women complete our fit finder. So we've gone, when I met you, it was early days. Nobody knew what Third Love was. I'm sure you had never heard of Third Love. And today I would say we're on our way to becoming a household name. So it's been a really exciting journey.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And I think one of the things that happens in entrepreneurship stories is they hear these details and it's like, oh, we're on our way to being a household name. We've got, you know, so many customers, people love us. And it seems like, oh, it's just that easy, right? It seems like, oh, well, that's great. You just start the company and then it just works. And then you just do that. That's done. It's still a lot, right? It's still a lot of problem solving, a lot of work. There were some challenges that you guys went through in sort of making Third Love into what it is. Can you talk a little bit about a story of it right at the beginning when you were living in Mexico, when you were doing some of the first manufacturing? Can you take us through that and sort of like what that challenge was?
Yeah, I mean, the first challenge we really faced as a company was, how do you get somebody to manufacture your product or sign an agreement with you when you don't have a brand and you don't have customers? It's very difficult when you're meeting with somebody and they say, well, where's your website? And you say, well, I don't have one yet because I don't have product to sell. So why would I have a website? It'll get built. There's a lot of inherent trust that you need to establish with a manufacturing partner. And so our first manufacturing partner was in Mexico, and they eventually decided they would work with us, and we started production. And what we quickly realized was the quality of the product coming off the line wasn't meeting the standards of Third Love and wasn't meeting the expectation of what I had set out to create. And that was extremely painful. It was painful for a lot of reasons. One, because I realized this product that we had sewn, we couldn't sell, because if we sold it, it wouldn't be good enough for our customers. And then second, I realized that we had dropped hundreds of thousands of dollars with this manufacturing partner that we were not going to recoup. And, you know, one of my regrets actually now, of course, reflecting back on those 3 to 6 months that I practically lived at the factory, is that we should have pulled the plug sooner. You know, we should have moved on sooner. We should have walked away sooner. It's very easy as an entrepreneur that you want to make something work, that you're going to force, you know, the square peg into the round hole. Like, you're going to make it happen. You're going to push. And at some point you have to realize, like, there's only so much pushing you can do, and you have to be willing to say, you know, what, I made a mistake. I really messed this up, and I'm going to walk away and I'm going to lose money. It's painful, but that was a part of the journey. And even though at the time it seemed like my world was coming to an end and I spent many, many nights, you know, waking up panicked about it, in the end, it actually worked out okay, because a lot of the learnings that we took from that first manufacturer, we brought to our second. It made onboarding a lot easier, and it made the second experience with our manufacturing partner a lot more positive. So it wasn't all for naught, I would say.
So I think what's interesting about what you said about living in Mexico, you're working through these manufacturing issues. When people think about manufacturing overseas, I don't think that they're thinking about that reality, like that you do have to work with the manufacturer, that it is a difficult process, that this is one of the biggest challenges that people who are making a product face, you know, communicating with these people. Do you find that that surprise with other entrepreneurs that they that it's just such a mind shift, the change that happens when you manufacture for the first time?
100%. In fact, I just had lunch with another female founder the other day, and she is about to start manufacturing her product in China. And she said to me, oh, they told me I don't need to go over to the factory, that they'll handle it, that they'll ship it, they'll QC it. And I just stopped her in her tracks. I was like, you need to get on a plane, get over there. You need to spend time in the factory, talk to who's managing it, put a name to a face. They need to know that you are going to be on them like glue. If you are not on them like glue, especially at the beginning, anything can happen. And you can lose a massive amount of time and money if you're not heavily involved. And then once you're up and running and you start to see the product coming off the line and it meets your expectations, then you can be a bit more hands off. But until that happens, everything leading up to that first shipment, you really, as the founder and the designer of the product, you need to be there. You need to be present and engaged and helping.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's it bears there's truth there for anybody creating any sort of product. You can't outsource knowledge. You can't outsource everything about your business, especially when it's and you certainly can't outsource responsibility. And I think that's one of the things that sometimes gets lost. Oh, I can just pay them to do that. That's fine. They're the experts. It's like, they are the experts, but they need guidance. When you were sort of having these late nights where you're up at night and you are thinking, gosh, what are we going to do? I think what's really interesting about that is when people sort of talk about these stories about how entrepreneurial success, we don't really talk about these moments, and these moments are real and these moments are important. And I think, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that so many people that are in the early days of their business and they aren't sure where to go, they don't realize that's natural, that that's part of the process. And this is helpful. it's a helpful part of problem solving.
But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Dan Bova, editorial director of Entrepreneur.com. Here's a crazy statistic. More than one quarter of all Americans say they'd start their own business in the next year if they could, but only a fraction of those actually do it. Why? Well, because taking that leap can be scary. So luckily, there's Weebly. Weebly is the easiest way to create an incredible looking website. But more importantly, it comes with a whole bunch of tools to help you sell your products, process payment, manage inventory, create marketing campaigns, and grow your brand. And because Weebly's mission is to help turn people's great ideas into successful businesses, they've built an incredible support team. If you have a question, just pick up the phone to talk to a customer success expert. No scripts, no robots, just a friendly human who can help you do what needs doing. So if you've got a product or idea you want to share with the world, check out Weebly. You can have a beautiful, powerful online store up and running in a matter of hours. And because you listen to this podcast, you can visit Weebly.com/HSH and get 15% off your first purchase. Don't just build a beautiful website, build a successful online business with Weebly.
Can you talk a little bit about what you were figuring out and why that was such a uncomfortable but a useful part of finding answers for your company?
Yeah, so I think you had two really, really good questions. So the first related to this feeling of panic or being alone or the world crashing in. It happens to every business owner, every founder. It continues to happen. It doesn't ever stop, because you, in some ways, are you're in your own bubble where it's hard to find people to talk to, because you can't just walk into your company and say, oh my God, and just sort of break down about, you know, your challenge, because you need to lead. So there's this inherent complexity to that. So my piece of advice would be, find some other entrepreneurs who are at a similar stage in non-competing industries where you really can pick up the phone and call somebody who might be going through something similar. And if you start to have that relationship over time, that can really be a support group and really literally a shoulder to cry on if you need it, that's outside of your day-to-day in your company. I think it's really, really important to at least have a few people. It doesn't have to be many, but a few will suffice. And then the second piece of your question, which is sort of, I guess, you know, what do you take away from it? Every bad decision that you make that you need to move on from makes you stronger. It makes you better able to do a similar type of decision faster and better the next time. So if instead of thinking about issues or challenges as a low point for you, I think you look at them as a way that it's furthering your ability to better problem solve and better make mistakes quicker and more efficiently going forward, because you'll continue to make mistakes, but hopefully every mistake you learn from, it makes your next mistake less impactful on the business.
Sure. There was another moment early in your business where you guys had the website all set up, the product is set, it's right, the quality is where you guys want it to be. Set up the website, and there's no customers yet, right? Because folks don't know you, and folks aren't used to buying bras online yet. They just, you know. Well, so tell me about that moment, because I think it's another really critical thing that happens early on in a business. You open the doors, and now you've got to figure out how you can kind of change behaviors and get folks in. What did you do? What did you and your team do? And maybe take us through that process.
For me, this was a very much a low point, I would say, just reflecting back the past few years. So this is, call it 2014, end of 2014 into 2015, maybe a team of, call it 10 to 12 people at Third Love, and finally having this really amazing product that we knew when women tried, they loved the bra. It was so comfortable, right? And it was everything we wanted it to be. So here we are, we've solved manufacturing. We're feeling really, really good, like pat on the back, like here we are, we have product, it's really great. And crickets, I literally say crickets, because sometimes you would go to our online platform and there would not be one customer order, not one, for the course of a day. It is incredibly demoralizing as a founder to be in that position. And you feel completely overwhelmed. Like, what are we going to do? We're going to go out of business. Like, we got to figure something out, you know, and today I can tell the story from the other side of having, you know, thousands and thousands of orders a day coming through, right? And so in this, and again, it's easy for my intro to be like, oh, things are great. And you know what? Things weren't always great. There was a moment in time where we didn't know if we could succeed. And so what we did was we were very real with our team. We sat down in a conference room similar to the one I'm sitting in today when I'm talking to you. There was 10 to 12 of us around the table. And we said, we've got to figure this out. If we don't figure this out, Third Love won't exist in a year. We've got to figure this out. And it was like, let's solve the problem. Like, why aren't women buying our bras? Like, why, when we put up a Facebook ad, is it costing $400 to acquire a customer, right? There's inherently something wrong we're doing with the messaging and the marketing of the product. And what we really came to realize through surveys and just data from people who had converted was it's really hard to trust Third Love if you say, we have the most comfortable bra, try it out. It's like, really? How do I know? How do I know that? I don't believe you. I've been let down in the past. I've never had a bra that fits. So what we had to do is take a step back and say, how do we solve that problem of us trying to say something and a woman just not latching onto it as truth? And so we came up with this idea of try before buying, where we said, listen, we believe in our product so much. You pay $2.99 for shipping. We'll send you the bra, take the tags off, wear it, wash it, make sure it's your new favorite bra. And if it's not, you send it back to us, free returns and exchanges, no questions asked. We'll just take back that bra. And that inherently, that program, which we proceeded to launch, really set the stage for us to reach a lot of women and take kind of the risk out of them trying us for the first time. And that was a big, big, bold idea that nobody was doing and was borderline insanity, because if it didn't work, it could have pushed us out of business. But it was a, it was, it ended up being the right decision, but it was a big moment for our company and a big turning point.
I think a lot of entrepreneurs and people in companies as well that are established companies, I think they do a launch and maybe they don't get traction right away. And they might have the initial instinct to say there's a problem with the product and try to fix the product, when in this case, it was really just an issue with trust, but also more than that, an issue with behavior. How do we get people to buy things online? I mean, it's 2018. People are buying groceries online now. They weren't buying groceries online in 2014, right? There are certain behaviors and things we have to get comfortable doing. And so you guys needed to get people comfortable buying a bra blindly from a company they've never heard of. It was a behavior change. Do you think that entrepreneurs, how do entrepreneurs solve the right problem?
That is a great question. I think you need to make sure you're asking a lot of questions of yourself and your team and make sure you're solving the thing that matters the most. And it's very easy to, yes, to get caught up in. And I, you know what I honestly think we all do is we make excuses, right? We say, well, it's this or it's that. Or, and it's like, okay, yes, those things matter. But really, there are a lot of things we do control. So let's talk about what we can control and impact, right? Not the external situation. So for us, 100%, you're right, right? This idea of buying a bra online was unique and was, you know, something that we had to work on getting customers comfortable with. And that's how the Fit Finder came about, was we said, not only do we need to make this try before buying program, but we actually need to create a tool that makes a woman feel very confident that she's going to get the right size. So we had to bring the expertise of an in-store bra fitter into kind of the technology and approach we used on our website to solve that need. So listen, it is about the external situation, but it's about solving that. Control what you can, build what you can, and that can impact change.
When you're asking people questions, right? Just asking a lot of questions, what does that look like? Like what's your process and what are you driving toward?
In terms of our customers?
Yeah. So if you're trying to solve a problem for your business, and in this case, maybe it's trying to solve a customer problem. Like how do we get more people into X or Y, you know? But any sort of problem solving that you're asking questions for, what is your process? Like how do you, a lot of people think that they're asking enough questions. I guarantee you that every person listening to this podcast thinks, oh, I asked them a couple things. I said, when does it do? What is the project? Oh, okay, great. And then they walk away, right? But they probably don't really have a real sense of the challenges that are facing that or the risks. Or I mean, what do you do to really get a sense and get a grasp on a situation that is happening in your business?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing to me is when I ask a question, is the answer that's coming out of somebody's mouth succinct and easy to understand? And does it inherently in my gut make sense to me? Because there's a lot of factors going on in a business and they all need to come together to create really great solutions. And so if I ask a question or there's some type of issue, if the answer comes back and in my gut it feels right and what somebody told me sounds accurate, most of the time I can move on from that. But there's many times, and you know this has happened to you, where somebody tells you something, and in your head you're kind of like, is that right? I'm not sure. You know, when you have those notions in your head, it's a time for you to stop as a leader and say, let's sit down for a second and continue to ask some questions, just rapid fire questions. Does the person you're talking to have a handle on the subject matter? Can they answer those questions? You'd be surprised how many times they're like, I don't know. I haven't looked into that. I haven't pulled that data. No, I didn't ask that customer question. It's like, okay, well, rewind. Like, we need to do all these things to make sure we have the right answer. So I think there's no such thing as asking too many questions. One of our company values is being curious. Mm-hmm. And what that means is asking a lot of questions. Don't just take the status quo of somebody saying, this is what we're doing. It's make sure that is the right decision. And the only way to know that is to ask a lot of questions.
Sure, sure. Well, and I think what's really interesting about that is well, a couple things. But first, just the idea that you want the answer to be succinct. Can we please return to this? Because I think it is so, so, so important. When something is succinct, to me, it also shows that person has a very strong handle on the topic at hand. I mean, can you talk a little bit about how important that is, how important that handling is, and why listening for that and the answer is so key?
Yeah. It's exactly what you said, but basically there's a complexity in the world we live in. There's a complexity of every business decision we make. And the best members on a team, of any team, on my team, have spent the appropriate amount of time and research to answer a complex question. And it's a massive amount that goes into that for any big strategic decision. It could have been days or weeks even of meetings and data and analysis. And really all of that should come together to be, here's my recommendation and here's the three reasons why we're doing it. Or here's the path I think we should take and the three major data points that have led me there. Because if they are able to present in a very clear way, here's where we should go and here's why, very, very clearly, it means that if I dig into any of those points and I say, well, you said this, they will have the backup to very easily articulate it. And if somebody starts rambling, which tends to happen, right? We've all been there. You ask a question and somebody's like, well, I think we should do this, but you know, there was this and this, and they start talking. And you're sort of like, I don't even know where you're going and I can't even follow the train of thought. And it seems like you're not quite sure. It means that they haven't done the synthesis of information to have a great recommendation, because they're actually talking you through their brainstorming process in the course of trying to answer your question. And that's not what I want, right? That means, wow, we need to go back. We need to figure out what that question was and we need to dig in more, and somebody needs to get a handle on something. So yeah, I think it's very, very telling, the length of somebody's reply as well.
Yeah. Well, I also think what's also important about the process of asking questions is not everyone will give you an answer. Like, to revisit what you said, just because someone gives you an answer, it doesn't mean that they know the answer. People feel pressured to give an answer, right? So there may be any number of things that they may say in order to move through a conversation. And I think that, like, tell me a little bit about also that process of listening for, is there something else happening with this answer? Are they trying to protect themselves? Are they trying to, do they feel pressured? I mean, is there something else there too that people need to be digging into when they are trying to get the right information so that they can, you know, answer a question?
Yeah. I mean, so we also try to ingrain here that there's no harm in ever saying, I don't know, or I'm not quite sure. Let me get back to you. Like, let me get back to you is a phrase that we all should use more, because it prevents this type of conversation. And it also prevents you from looking like you haven't put together cohesive thoughts. And I think that we all collectively as a world could just learn a lot from just respect you on that. You know, there's no harm in taking a step back. And so we really, as a company, try to focus on that. But I also inherently feel like a lot of times, you know, when you're going to be in a meeting or you're running a meeting or you're presenting to senior leadership at any company, you want to be buttoned up. And I always say to my team, what's the thing that you need to focus on is the so what. So what? Why do I care? Why does everybody sitting here, why are people listening to you? They don't need to know the backstory. They don't need to know everything that went into it. They need to know the so what. And so when you talk to somebody in your head, if you're thinking, I'm going to tell them the so what, why they should care, that keeps you focused on inherently saying something that matters to somebody.
Yeah, definitely. You spend time at least once a month at your customer experience center. Tell us about that. Why do you do that?
Yeah, so we have a brand new office we opened up in Chico, California, with over 100 fit stylists, and hiring another 100 this year. So it'll be 200 by year end. So a big building. Our fit stylists, I tell this to them every time that I'm up there, they are the representation of the brand in human form. So if you are a Third Love customer and you have any kind of question and you reach out over chat or text or email or phone, you will talk to one of our fit stylists. And inherently, they need to know that they are the connection to the customer. And I love being up there because I can listen. And what I do when I walk around that office is I listen. I probably spend 80% of my day up there listening and the other 20% talking, to give you a sense. Because what I can hear is customer interaction. So I can hear sort of from the response of the fit stylist generally, I get a sense of what the customer is asking. So that's very interesting. I can kind of get a handle on what our customers are writing in for or calling in for. I can also hear how we're responding to them. What's the tone? How are we solving their problem? And is it on brand? And are we doing it efficiently? So it gives me a really good sense of both inbound and outbound and sort of how we're servicing our customers, because that's a huge component of our business.
You've mentioned that those early experiences with at Third Love, both with manufacturing and things, that they helped you make decisions more quickly. Can you talk a little bit about why that is and also why it's important to make decisions quickly?
Yes. So I think in the early days for me, making big decisions, especially painful ones, took a long time because I didn't want to do them is probably the truth behind that. If I look back, it's because it is embarrassing, to be completely candid and honest, to look your investors in the eye or look your team in the eye and say, listen, I made this big strategic decision and it was the wrong one. It's embarrassing. And it's embarrassing for anyone to admit that they failed. And then what you realize is that once you've done that once or twice, that you are still the founder, that people do still trust you, and that it's okay. And once you realize that, you become less embarrassed and it just becomes easier to make those quicker decisions because you realize that the world is not going to fall apart. And that is a journey that every founder has to have for themselves. But what it leads you down a path towards is much more effective leadership and much more effective decision making. And for me, for you know, leading a startup, part of our success, I would say inherently a huge, huge part of our success is how quickly we move. We do everything quickly. And we pride ourselves on that. So we are successful because of that. And when we fail and do things wrong, we try to do that really quickly too. And that pace is hugely important to our success. And it's something that keeps me up at night now as we scale as a team and a company. How do we keep that pace of change going as we get bigger? And I think about that every single day because it's so important. Moving quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's different than a different startup adage, you know, that sort of, you know, move fast, break things type of, you know, iterate often thing. It's a little bit different because what you're saying is you want to keep moving. And so instead of, I think some folks, especially early on, if they've got a side hustle as well, if they're in the very, very, very early days, there's this hesitancy. There's this sense of, let's just wait till it's perfect. This represents all of me. I've put my whole soul into this. How can I make sure that it's perfect, right? And I think anybody listening to this, if they were thinking, how can I just move forward, that there's this sense of progress that they'll achieve that is more powerful than perfection will ever give them. I mean, how important is just moving forward and developing, pushing that development?
And nothing's ever going to be perfect. You know, I look at Tesla, right, and Elon Musk. It's like, you can't, those first cars coming off the line were not perfection, right? And it doesn't matter what you're producing. Nothing is ever going to be perfect. The first bra we produced wasn't perfect. The first iteration of our fit finder wasn't perfect. But at least we got the wheels greased, and you need the motion, the forward motion, to propel you and your team ahead. And it actually helps with morale. People want to be part of a company that is making progress. And so yeah, I do think the 80-20 rule definitely holds. We talk about that a lot, and there's a reason why it exists, because it does make sense. It's like, just 80% there. The last 20% may or may not come and will come over time, but just get 80% there. So, you know, you need to have a product that you feel good about, but it doesn't have to be perfection. Just everybody needs to keep moving. Moving is more important than perfection for sure.
Sure, sure. And what are the symptoms of that, right? In moving quickly, does that mean that at the end of every meeting, there are action items that are tangible? Tell me what that looks like. Somebody listening to this is like, okay, I need to make sure that I'm on this phone call, that we've done X or Y. I'm in a meeting. We do Z or whatever. What is it actually in day-to-day? What does it look like?
Well, I think as a leader or a manager at a company, it's setting goals that are hard to achieve. Because in order to make progress and move quickly, people need to be pushed and stretched. And you may not always meet those goals, but at least you'll get, you know, if you set your goals at 150% and the team comes in at 120 or 110, you're above 100, right? So it's all a sliding scale. So I think that's important. And the second is you need to let go and give your team the ability to run and implement in a way that you might not have done yourself. So I think what's really important, especially as you grow, if you have people on your team who are in charge of a certain initiative, you may have done it a certain way and gotten to where you needed to go. And they may be doing it in a different way, and that's okay. And for me as a founder, I think that was a really big moment where I had to learn to let go of trying to give the play-by-play to my team of like, this is how I would do it, right? This is how I'd map it out. This is how I'd think about it. It's like, no, you're smart. You are accomplished. You are capable. You do it in your own way. And if you have questions, come and ask me. I'm happy to input, but you know what? You should own it. Do it in your own way. Make it yours. Empower your team. You'll never accomplish massive goals if you hold on to all of these, you know, the way you do it. It's not about you. It's about the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. How do you think you've changed in the last 5 years and sort of how you make decisions?
I've become, my skin has become so much thicker. I don't even know if I'd recognize the person I was 5 years ago. When in early days, I was much more sensitive to everything. I was sensitive to what investors would say when they didn't want to invest and tell you, you know, they don't love your company. I was sensitive to customers who might complain about us not carrying a certain size, or, you know, we hadn't delivered at the level I wanted to. It really, really impacted me on a personal level. And I've really become thicker skinned where those things today don't bother me in the same way as they used to. Meaning I hear feedback. I hear what somebody says. I do take it into account, but then I move on. I need to focus on the future, not the past. And that's really my motto, is every day is a new day. And so what happened yesterday isn't going to impact me today. And I try to look ahead. And that has made me successful. If you can't do that, you will never succeed as a founder, because it's too much to do both. You can't focus on the future and the past at the same time.
You meet when possible with up and coming women founders and sort of share what you can with them. You know, what do you help them with, and why is it important for you to reach out to these women that are sort of on their way up?
Yeah, so I think I told you this when we met in person, but I get a lot of female founders who email me about their company or wanting to chat, and I always say yes. I always do those calls. I always try to help where I can. Of course, I can't do everything, but I always do try to make that connection, because I think the network of female founders is so small, and it's so important to have role models, and I really want there to be more female founders. There should be way more, and anything I can do to help in that goal, I will do. But some of what I help them on is really introductions, is thinking about how to pitch their business. A lot of them are raising seed rounds, so they're in the early days that we were in, you know, 4.5, 5 years ago. So a lot of it in what I call the boys network out here, especially in Silicon Valley, men tend to know other men at VC firms because, you know, 97% of partners at VC firms are male. So just inherently, gender creates a network that is different for men versus women out here. And so what I really try to do is make introductions to female partners at VC firms or male partners at VC firms and really help be a conduit into that world, because that's hugely important. And then also just thinking through their pitch idea and how they're presenting, because I think there's some inherent differences in the way that women and men pitch their business to get funding. And in order for women to raise the kind of rounds that men raise, there needs to be a slight change in how they approach it. So coaching like that is something else I've done.
Sure. For anybody listening to this, what would you like them to sort of keep in mind, whether it has to do with how they can ask better questions, how they can move more quickly, or how they can, you know, reach out to somebody and somebody who could be a mentor to them? You know, what should anybody listening to this, take to heart?
So I think it's really important to not be afraid to ask questions to others. There's a lot of people in front of you who have made similar kinds of decisions or made mistakes, and you can really learn from that. So I think if there's somebody out there who's a few years ahead of you doing something similar, see if you can learn from them, see if they can help, see if they're open to that. It can save a lot of frustration and time and money, point one. But point two is always believe in your gut. So in the lack of anything else, when push comes to shove and you have to make a decision, go with your gut. It's always served me correctly. And those times where I've made excuses for not going with my gut, I've always regretted the decision. So if you don't have anything else to go off of, just use your instinct, because that will serve you well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I don't want to take more of your day here, Heidi, but this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for all of your insights and all of your stories.
So nice to talk to you, and so great to connect after 4.5 years. So
absolutely. And before we go, some short announcements for our listeners. How Success Happens comes out weekly. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud, or wherever you get your favorite podcast. And don't be afraid to leave us a review. It helps us improve and reach more listeners just like you. For more stories like this one on the mindset you need to make big things happen, go to entrepreneur.com. And to let me know what you think about the show, find me on Twitter at Linda Lacina. That's the @ symbol, L-I-N-D-A-L-A-C-I-N-A. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.